Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Jack Kelly, author of the new book, Valcour, the 1776 campaign that saved the cause of liberty. Jack, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Well, a lot of people are familiar with the major American Revolution battles and campaigns, such as Lexington and Concord or the Battle of Bunker Hill. Can you tell us about Valcour and its importance in the American Revolution?
Yeah, I often refer to this as the most important unknown battle of the Revolutionary War. And there's a number of reasons why it's important, and there's a number of reasons why it's unknown. The importance was that in 1776, which was the crucial year of the Revolution, the British were intending to attack from Canada down a corridor that runs down the St. Lawrence River, Lake Champlain, and then down the Hudson River to New York City. That was the main access to the interior of America. It was really the only route that was open from Canada into the rebellious colonies, and it was the back door to New England. So once they got on Lake Champlain, which is in northern New York, or on the Hudson River, they could attack eastward into New England, which was really the seat of the rebellion at that time. So their strategy was to attack both ends of that corridor. They attacked from Canada, and came down the Lake Champlain, and they attacked New York City. Of course, George Washington, most people are much more familiar with the campaign in around New York City, in which George Washington was quite soundly defeated. So if the British had been able to succeed in coming down Lake Champlain and getting onto the Hudson River from the north, that would probably have ended the war. And that was the intent of the British that year in 1776. They wanted, in one season, to put down the rebellion. They sent over the largest expeditionary military force in their history to do so. So the fact that the British were stopped from that invasion from the north, it was crucial to the continuing the war. Of course, Washington made his great coup by crossing the Delaware River on Christmas night in 1776, and somewhat restoring morale down around the New York area. But I think the battle on Lake Champlain was really crucial to the outcome of the war.
Well, the British Navy is heralded for its accomplishments and expertise. How did the scrappy Navy of quickly constructed gunboats fight the British Navy? Were there specific naval tactics that the Americans used against the British?
Yes, it was a very improvised battle, particularly on the American side. They had to build a fleet of gunboats. These were about boats were about 50 feet long. They were really oversized rowboats. They had a sail, but they were not. Particularly seaworthy. They had, each of the gunboats had three cannon on them. They had a few larger boats, schooners and so forth, but all relatively small boats. The British built some larger boats. They weren't able to sail because there's rapids along the connection between the St. Lawrence River in Canada and Lake Champlain, which there's a river called the Richelieu River that connects the two of them. They had to build their ships or dismantle ships and then bring them up and rebuild them closer to the lake. But they had much larger ships. And of course, the Americans were using, their crews were mostly drawn from the army, so they were not that familiar with sailing. They had to train them. They had to complete the boats as quickly as possible. They spent about 6 weeks building the small fleet and then stand up to the British, the Royal Navy. which was manned by very experienced sailors and gunners and so forth. So it was a very much a David and Goliath kind of battle. I think we have to give credit to the main commander of the American fleet, who happened to be Benedict Arnold. And that's somewhat surprising to a lot of people who only think of Benedict Arnold as somebody who betrayed his country. But he was he had been a sea captain before the war started, and he was very familiar with sailing. And he was the person that really managed the building of the fleet and then was the captain of the fleet and set the strategy for defeating the British on Lake Champlain.
And were we able to do that by just kind of overwhelming the ships with these small gunboats?
Strategy that Benedict Arnold came up with was to hide his fleet. The northern part of Lake Champlain, which is sort of right on the Canadian border, is very complex. There's several hundred islands in there, a lot of coves and inlets. And one of those islands that's down along the New York shore was called Valcour Island. And it's about a mile offshore. He took his fleet, and he had about 8 gunboats and maybe a half a dozen other small ships, and hid them behind that island. The British, having built this much larger fleet, came roaring down the lake once they finally got ready. And they had assumed that he would retreat. That would have been the logical thing to do. Because he had a smaller fleet and he was likely to be defeated, they wanted to catch up with him. So they didn't go and explore behind every island and in every cove. And he let them go past Valcour Island, then sent some of his boats out to fire on them from behind, and then drew back into a cove or a bay behind Valcour Island. And the British had to turn around and then come back into the wind with their ships and try to get into this rather narrow bay where the Americans had set up their line of gunboats. So they were unable to get most of their larger ships into there. They couldn't tack back and forth well enough to move against the wind. Mm-hmm. So they ended up fighting the British gunboats, which were, they had more numerous gunboats, but they, each of them only had one cannon on them. And it was largely a cannon duel, went on all day. And they basically fought the British to a draw. And they were then trapped inside this bay by the larger British ship. So it looked like it was going to be curtains for them in the morning, but at least they'd held off the British fleet for that day.
And can you tell us about the roles of General Philip Schuyler and the former British officer Horatio Gates played in Valcour?
Yeah, that's General Schuyler is his name. He was a Dutch...
Schuyler. Okay.
Yeah. He was a Dutch, very wealthy Dutch businessman from Albany, and actually spoke Dutch at home. Albany was a Dutch-speaking town at that time. And he was the overall commander in the North. He was the equivalent of George Washington, who was commanding the army in the South. And he basically stayed in Albany and handled the logistics. And that was a crucial role, and he was very good at it, having been a businessman, having wide connections, to be able to get the supplies up to Lake Champlain that they needed. Lake Champlain was pretty much frontier at that time. There were a few settlements, but very few. And so they had to ship all the equipment and all the nautical supplies and get the lumber and get the iron and get the anchors and get the guns all shipped up there to the southern point on the lake where they're building the ships. So that was his largely his role in the campaign. General Gates was in charge at Fort Ticonderoga, which is about the middle of Lake Champlain on the New York shore. And that was the main defensive position. That was where they were going to meet the British once they came down. And his role, he didn't know that much about nautical matters, but he knew how to restore the morale of the army that was there, how to fortify Fort Ticonderoga, which had been fallen into some disrepair, and to essentially organize the defenses that the British would have to overcome if they were to move down farther down the lake. So it turned out to be a combination operation, really. First, a naval battle on the lake. Well, first, I should take a step back and say, first, mm-hmm. it was the building of the fleets. It was like an arms race. And that went on for about 2 months. It was during the summer. That delay was very important, proved to be very important for the Americans. Then there was the battle on the lake, and then the Americans prepared to meet the British. The American fleet was ultimately defeated, and they prepared to meet the British fleet at Ticonderoga. And by that time, it was November, and the British, who were very familiar from General Carleton was the commander of the British forces, and he had been governor of Canada for some time, and he was very familiar with how cold it got up there. And it really does get cold in northern New York, even in September. They're now approaching November, and he was afraid that if he attacked Fort Ticonderoga, the lake would freeze behind him, and that would have been a disaster for the British because they would have cut off their supplies from the north. So he made the decision, well, we've dealt with the American fleet now. We can just go back to Canada, spend the winter there in comfort, and come back and start the campaign again the following year. And that's exactly what he did. And that saved the cause for the Americans, combined with George Washington's coup at Trenton in December. It gave them some breathing room. They had another year to prepare, and that was what allowed them really to carry on the war.
So why did you decide to write about the Battle of Valcour?
Well, I had written an earlier book called A Band of Giants, which was an overview of the Revolutionary War and a closer sort of personal examination of some of the lesser known American commanders. And one of them was Benedict Arnold. And I was reading about Arnold's great feat on Lake Champlain. And I thought it was curious that, it was not something that most people were familiar with. I had heard of it sort of just casually, but it was not given much importance. In fact, David McCullough, who wrote a wonderful book about the Revolutionary War called 1776, that was focused on that year in the mm-hmm. Revolutionary War, never mentioned the Northern Campaign whatsoever in that whole book. And that was a book focused on the war in that year. And so that's why I refer to it as the most important unknown battle of the war. The reason it's unknown, I think, partly was it was remote. I mean, Lake Champlain is still pretty remote, up in the Adirondack Mountains. There's not, northern Vermont. Not a lot of people are familiar with it. At that time, it was really wilderness. But largely, I think the campaign was ignored because of Benedict Arnold. It was, even though Washington was soundly defeated down in around New York City, it was much easier to sing the praises of George Washington than it was to praise Benedict Arnold once he had betrayed his country. So everything that he participated in, and his role was diminished. And I think that's largely the reason that the campaign was ignored.
Sure. So are you researching or already writing your next book?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I'm what I decided to do, having gotten even more interested in Benedict Arnold from writing this book, was to really go back and take another look at Benedict Arnold. I think it's what I want to do is to show, not to condone or excuse his betrayal, but to show that he was one of the not only the great effective generals of on the American side, but was really somebody who pushed the war into existence in its early stages. I've talked about Fort Ticonderoga, for example.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
If the Americans had not gained control of Fort Ticonderoga, it's very possible that the war never would have really gotten off the ground, because the British could easily have come down. The British, in 1775, when the war began at Lexington and Concord, the British controlled Fort Ticonderoga. And if they continued to control it, they would have had easy access down that corridor that I mentioned, and into the colonies. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't have had to fought these battles in 1776. And he was responsible for taking over Fort Ticonderoga, and then for he immediately went up to Canada and captured one of the only British significant warship on the lake, and brought it down to use it for on the American side. That allowed the Americans to put up a defense in the north, which they wouldn't have been able to do without that. So there are so many things about Benedict Arnold that were crucial to the war that were then ignored by historians, or denigrated by historians over the years because of his betrayal. So that's my goal in writing about him, would be to sort of show what a hero he was early in the war, and how tragic it was that he did decide to change sides and go over to the British.
Sure. So what was your research process when you were working on writing your book, Valcour?
A lot of the material I got was writing about the Revolutionary War. I think historians have somewhat of an advantage, because many of the original documents of the war were published, particularly during the bicentennial years in the 1970s. So the the naval documents, the American archives, that are just these huge collections of multi-volume collections of documents, are not only now published, but most of them are available online. So there's a lot of original material. You can see the letters that were written back and forth, or the orders that went down from one commander to another. You can actually read those. And a lot of the research I did was from that. But I traveled up to Lake Champlain. I spent a lot of time looking over the sites and trying to get a feel for the place and what it was like up there. There's a wonderful museum called the Lake Champlain Maritime Museum that built a replica, an exact replica of one of the American gunboats, and put cannon on it and had it constructed exactly as the gunboats would have been. So that's a great resource for, just like living history, to be able to see what the size of the boat and what the life would have been like on that boat. Fort Ticonderoga itself has been rebuilt, and they have great programs there that try to bring to life the fort and the life in the fort. So the combination of those two things, and I've read a lot of the biographies of the various characters. Philip Schuyler, for example, is not a very well known American Revolution general, but played a very crucial role in this campaign, and was quite an interesting character, and his involvement in the history in Albany in the northern New York area.
Well, I know that you earlier wrote several crime novels. Why did you make the switch from novels to writing nonfiction history books?
Well, that's a good question. partly it's just a kind of a shift in interest, I guess I'd have to say. I started getting interested in history, and I always try to link those two aspects of my career by saying that I'm always looking for ways to examine the extremes of human experience, let's say. And I think crime and war both deal with people who are in those extreme situations. I wrote a book about the Dillinger Gang and the bank robbers of the 1930s. And I said, to imagine yourself walking into a bank and you have a submachine gun under your coat, and you haven't started the robbery yet. You just walked in. What are you thinking? What is that? What is that experience like to actually be that person doing that? And I tried to recreate that in my writing and writing about those things. And the same thing in wars. Like you're waiting for these British ships to come down on top of you with cannon that fire supersonic, essentially balls about the size of a softball, moving at supersonic speeds that can blast through 3 inches of oak. And even if they come near you, they're going to knock you down. And if they hit you, they're going to kill you. And there's no way there's nowhere to hide. There's no way, you can't take cover because it'll go right through the ship. What is that experience like? So I like to get at those types of personal experience. And I think it, in either case, it kind of brings the story to life rather than just the sort of dry description of what happened.
Sure. Well, what writing advice would you offer for those who are working on their own stories or novels or nonfiction books?
I think that to start out with, and I used to teach a class in screenwriting, which is interesting because it's very fundamental storytelling. You know, movies are not, they're not, there's not a lot of subtlety, and there's not a lot of, you know, depth necessarily, but you have to have that story. You have to, and I'd say, you know, do the research, and the more you learn, the more ideas you'll have about the situation. I had a student who was writing about some kind of a crime movie that he wanted to, and it involved a police dispatcher, and as the dispatcher was describing the crime or something that was going on, he got more and more and more excited, and he was yelling, and I said, you ought to do some research on that instead of just thinking you're going to make it up out of your head, because that's exactly the opposite of what happens in reality. The more intense the situation, the more any dispatcher is going to speak in very clipped and very dry tones, because they need to get the information across. I mean, that's that's part of the process of learning to be a dispatcher in the police. Little things like that can make a big difference, I think. So that type of research is important. And of course, on the other hand, you don't want to spend so much time in research that you never get around to writing your story. And that's one of the, I think, more valuable pieces of advice that I got when I was learning to write, was the most important thing about the first draft of any book is to finish it. Doesn't matter, does it come out well? Does it not come out well? Is it including everything you wanted to? Finish it. Then you can go back and fill in. Then you can, but if you write a quarter and say, well, oh, I've got to go research a lot more of this to find this out, you end up not finishing, and you don't get the big picture of what you're writing about until you finish that first draft. So I think certainly I found that to be good advice. Just push through, finish the draft, and then go back and start your revisions, which to me is the real work of writing and the real pleasure, really. I always enjoy revising and polishing and adding, you know, little details. That's where you're actually doing the writing. But having that first draft, it gives you your foundation. So I think that's an important aspect of it.
I'm curious, with the nonfiction history books that you write now, when you're writing, do you get to sections where you know you, as you're writing it, you realize that you need to do more research, and do you just make notes and then kind of go back and do additional research? How does that work for you?
Yeah, I think that would be a good description of it. I tend to do quite a bit of research before I even start, but then right through, and if it's something I say, I need to get into more detail about this or that aspect of the story, I will just sort of note that down and then continue on, and then go back and do that research and add that. But I try to avoid, you know, write a little bit and research a little bit. I think you do a sort of basic research and then try to imagine the story, you know, to forget about the research, just what you know about it. Mm-hmm. Write the story, and then, okay, there's going to be gaps and areas you want to flesh out, so that you want to go back and do more research afterwards.
Gotcha. So what nonfiction books or novels have you read recently that you enjoyed?
I could point to two books that I found particularly enjoyable, and actually in the middle of the first one, which is called Jesse James, The Last Rebel of the Civil War. And to me, that's a really exemplary piece of nonfiction. It's not, as it's, the title tends to make you think of a cowboy type story, you know, of Western. but it's really a portrait of Missouri during the before, during, and after the Civil War. And Jesse James was a participant in the activities that went on there, which are absolutely mind-boggling in their horror of what the neighbor against neighbor, because Missouri was split right down the middle between the southern slave holders and the more northern people who were opposed to slavery. And we think of this myth of Jesse James, sort of the gunfighter and the bank robber, which he turned into later. But during the Civil War and then immediately following the Civil War, he was a an absolute sadistic psychopathic killer, and as were many of the what they called bushwhackers out there. So it's an interesting story, and it's a portrait of the time as well as following along his life story. Another book which I read not too long ago was called Golden Hill, and it was a story about New York City in the 1720s, I think. And it was like a very, very effective evocation of what New York was like in those early days when it was just a small town, really, at the tip of Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And what the combination of the Dutch influence, again, and interestingly, both of these books incorporated elements of slavery into them. You know, the slavery was a big factor in the story of Jesse James, and it was also a factor in this book, because slavery was quite common in New York at that time. And but it's a very rollicking, fast-moving story, very adventurous story, but also, you know, had these elements that was obviously very well researched about New York in the 18th century.
Well, where can people find you online if they'd like to learn more about you and your books?
I have a website. It's called jackkellybooks.com. And I have a contact page on there if you have any questions, people have any questions, or I always like to hear, you know, comments from people who have any reaction to what I've done. And I have information about all my books on there. So, and the Valcour, in fact, I even have a link if you want to get a signed copy of the book. I've arranged with a bookstore near me to, you know, have signed copies available, and they'll ship them out to anyone. So that's, I'm not really
great.
I have a presence on Facebook, but I can't say I'm not really a devotee of Facebook or Twitter. So those right. are a little inactive, but I'm also on there.
Sure. Well, again, we've been speaking with Jack Kelly, author of the new book, Valcour, the 1776 Campaign That Saved the Cause of Liberty. The book is on sale now, so go buy a copy. And Jack, thanks for doing this interview.
Well, thank you, Jeff. It's really been fun.
Great.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.